Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the comedian Sarah Millican. Her Every Woman Yet No Holds Barred style of comedy has brought her sell-out tours and several of her own highly successful series on the BBC. Revelling in normality and drawing on the difficult, intimate and often excruciating moments of being human, she dares to say what most of us are thinking, only she's funnier. Much, much funnier. A Geordie born in South Shields, her dad was an engineer down the mines and her mum was a hairdresser. They encouraged their daughter in her storytelling and performing, even though her childhood shyness meant she'd recite her poetry from behind the living room curtains. Later, it was pain that first propelled her onto the stage, when a broken early marriage provided the catalyst she needed to find the courage to confront the glaring judgment of the audience's gaze. Her rise was then rapid. Within 4 years, she was awarded Best Newcomer at the Edinburgh Fringe. She says, "People come along and think, oh, she's being too rude. They don't realise I'm just like this at home. People think I'm prim and proper at home, but I'm not. I'm just me, transplanted onto the stage." So do you find, are you one of those people then that finds comedy in everything in real life, Sarah Millican?
I try to, because I think it's quite a good way of thinking about things. So something horrible happens to you, but there's something funny in the middle of all of that. It somehow lightens it and maybe makes it easier to handle. So it is something I look for.
I think every comedian I ever speak to is always sort of looking for material because, you know, whether it's television or being on the road, that is a voracious beast. You know, it gobbles up the material. Yes. Are you always sort of on red alert for good material?
Yeah, but good material can come from just having a conversation with a friend. So what I find is if the only jokes I can think of are related to driving or hotels, then I know I need to see my friends or maybe go supermarket shopping or go to the cinema or just do some normal things. And then all of a sudden material comes again.
And what makes you laugh? I mean, a proper sort of gut laugh that comes from nowhere.
Oh, loads of things. I'm such a laugher. Everyday conversations with my husband or my family make me laugh a lot. My sister always says, you know, we're all funny in our house. Sarah's the only one that gets paid. And which I love. I love the sort of mild arrogance of that. But also it's true. I'm not the funny one when I go home. We are all funny.
You do have probably a fair reputation for having what I might politely term as a bit of a potty mouth on you.
It's not only you that calls me that.
Yes. Do your mum and dad get sort of kind of clip you around the ear for that?
No, not at all. No, because I've always been like that. Just now it's my job. So therefore, it's justified. No, because my mum once said that she thought I was quite coarse on stage, but she doesn't realise that, geez, where I get it from. Like, I get the storytelling from my dad, but I get the rudeness and the filth from my mum.
I got in a right old kerfuffle in my head introducing you as a Geordie, because I've had so many opinions today about what is a Geordie and what isn't a Geordie. Technically, are you a Geordie?
According to my dad, who I think is like the ultimate in truth, because that's what you're supposed to think of your dad. He's the oracle. Then yes, because apparently being a Geordie means you were born on the banks of the Tyne, and I was born in South Shields. But technically, I'm also a sand dancer. But nobody really says that much because it doesn't sound as cool, does it?
Letters, please, about this to Sarah Millican. For now, it's time for your first disc, Sarah. Tell me about this and why you've chosen it.
My first disc is Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go by Wham. Mm-hmm. Many reasons. It's the first single I ever bought. I play it every day because I play it while I'm changing the cat litter. We've got like a really old kind of ghetto blaster where I normally do the cat litter. And it's got like an I Love Whatever That Year Is CD in it. And second track is this song. So I play it on repeat because it's one of a handful of songs, I think, that I can listen to for a long period of time and never get sick of it, which I think on a desert island is probably quite an important factor. But also I think it would remind me of cleaning cat litter trays, which makes me feel like a good cat mom. You put the boom boom into my heart. You send my soul sky high when your loving starts. A jitterbug into my brain. It goes to bang, bang, bang till my feet do the same. But something's bugging, something ain't right. My best friend told me what you did last night. You left me sleeping in my bed.
That was Wham and Wake Me Up Before You Go Go. Is it true? I've heard rumours, Sarah Millican, that you have a George Michael nightie.
Not anymore. I used to have it. It was just a long T-shirt with George Michael on, but I wore it for bed. I think I wanted him to be close to my heart when I slept.
I sometimes wonder, when I watch the guests on your TV show, and it is a mixture of stand-up and their little skits, and then you do interviews with people, pretty much always men, and ask them often these innuendo-laden questions that are, you know, well, they're hysterically funny. Do the guys know what you're going to ask them?
No.
No, they never look like they know.
Oh, no, that's no fun. No. They know that it's not going to be mean and that it's going to be fun and that it might be cheeky. I think that's as far as we go. But generally, you ease somebody into an interview. So you ask them a few nice questions and then you go, right, now we're ready. They're softened, their walls are down. Our policy was always just to do that question first. And absolutely floor them. And it generally did.
It is impossible, it seems, right now to talk to a woman who is working in comedy without raising the prospect of women in comedy. Now, you might well sort of let out a bit of a sigh at this, but I wonder what you make of these new guidelines, certainly within the BBC and more broadly, they seem to be being taken up within your industry, of saying, yes, you know, we need to see women on these panel shows and it's not fair that, you know, every time we turn them on, we see five men and often just no women at all.
I don't know. I think if that's the only way that you can get some people to take female panellists, then I suppose that's the way it has to be. But I just think it's really disappointing that sort of, you know, 51% of the population has to have a quota in order to get on to have a representation on a telly programme. Seems a bit ridiculous. But if that's the only way it happens, then I guess that's the way it has to be.
At your gigs, as I understand it, they don't do a big turn on the bar, do they? They're not a big boozy crowd.
No, they're not. Because I think you are reflected in your audience. There was one time in, I think it was Portsmouth, where they came backstage in the interval and said, it's kicking off at the bar. And I thought, my audience, all in their cardigans? I don't think so. Turns out they'd run out of ice cream, which says all you need to know about my audience.
That's your second piece of music, Sarah Millican. What's next?
My second piece of music is Perry Como's Home for the Holidays.
And why this?
It is a song that we used to play when we were kids. My mum and dad had a Perry Como Christmas album that was trotted out every year, apart from the year that they couldn't find it. And I swear that in the July, somebody had given me permission to take it to the Blue Peter Bring and Buy sale. Somebody had. I don't remember which parent. But it's also a song that we used to use to sort of actively puncture any tension. So, for example, if there was an argument, like there are arguments, if all families have arguments, somebody in the family would always start singing, oh, there's no place like home for the holidays, in a sarcastic way, and it would just undercut it. Everybody would laugh and the tension had gone.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays, 'cause no matter how far away you roam, when you pine for the sunshine of a friendly gaze, for the holidays you can't beat home sweet home.
I met a man who lives in Tennessee, and he was heading for Pennsylvania.
That was Perry Como and Home for the Holidays, and memories for you, Sarah Millican, of just life at home, family life, and sometimes little arguments and people using that song to get through the little arguments. This little girl that was behind the curtains reciting poetry then, tell me a little bit more about her.
Oh,
what were you reciting? What was the poem?
You're not going to make me do it, are you?
You're ahead of me.
Oh, God, there's so many verses, Kirsty. You haven't got time.
Just give us the first verse.
OK. Christmas is a lot of fun and Santa Claus has just begun to wrap up presents, lots of toys, all wrapped together for girls and boys.
Oh, I thought that was rather lovely. Thank you.
I can't believe you made me do my Christmas poem.
You were born in 1975.
Yes.
In South Shields in Tyne and Wear. Valerie and Philip, your mum and dad. Tell me a little bit more about home life.
I always remember being quite sort of tap dancey as a child, which is, it probably sounds really irritating. I certainly never had any lessons or anything like that. Just whenever we got new shoes, we had a Coke boiler, and around the Coke boiler was tiles, and we just go on and do a little tap dance in our shoes. And I used to write poems and things like that, and I would always perform. But then outside of home, I was very quiet and very sort of bookish. But I think At Home was just such a comfortable place. It was always somewhere that you felt like you could be 100% yourself.
So would you have been in the school shows, or would you have...
I was the narrator one year because I had a good speaking voice. And I was once third child in A Christmas Carol. And I had to say, "Here's Martha, Mother." That was my line. I didn't want to be a star. I wanted to be involved in the kind of rehearsals and behind the scenes-y sort of stuff, which sort of led on to when I kind of wanted to be a film writer or a film director in my sort of teens and 20s.
Your mum was a hairdresser, is that
yes.
right? But not for long. She didn't...
Not for long, because she had polio. So the fact that she battled to even only do that for a few years is, I think, a sign of the kind of drive that she had.
And so did she, even though she couldn't any longer work in a salon, did people come and did she do their hair at home, or did she just give it up completely?
She did ours.
Did she?
Yeah.
Home
she
perm.
Did a lot of home perms.
Did she? What age were you when you had your first perm?
My very first perm. I think I was probably too young. Is there too young? And we had a cupboard that was sort of a larder, I suppose, that had a door. When you open the door, there's a mirror, full-length mirror, and she'd put a chair in front of it. Open the cupboard, chair in front, and that's how you got your hair cut. Most of the time it was brilliant and she was great, and I would go in looking like a Bobby Dazzler. But there was one time that I had quite a lot of growth on my perm, quite a lot of straight at the top. So she permed on top of the perm, and then said she was just going to take the edges off, and got a little bit scissor happy. And I went from having sort of hair past my shoulders curly to the next day just going back into school with like boy short hair. And I thought, I'm going to get ribbed for this. This is going to be awful. Because I wasn't popular at school. I was quite sort of slightly bullied and sort of picked on a little bit because I was quite quiet. And I thought, this is going to be awful. And I went back into school next day and nobody noticed. That's the joy of being a wallflower.
Is that in a way even sadder that nobody knows?
Yes, but also sadder in, yeah, looking at it back now, it was probably quite sad. But at the time, it was brilliant because nobody noticed.
It surprises me that you weren't a popular girl at school because you seem so sort of warm and friendly. Has that come later?
I think I was warm and friendly then, but I just don't think... I was quite studious and I don't think that gets you many friends at school. I got on really well with the teachers. That doesn't get you many friends. I think I was 12 and my maths teacher came to my birthday party. That says a lot, doesn't it?
That says a lot. Yes.
That's all you need to know. We should stop now, Kirsty.
more than any question I'm about to ask you ever could. Let's have your third piece of music. Tell me about this.
My third song is Pharrell Williams' Happy. I think on a desert island, I'm going to need something that's going to make me jig along, and I think this will be the one.
That was Pharrell Williams and Happy. Lots of us, Sarah Millican, have met your dad, Philip. We've met him on TV because, of course, he infamously or famously makes appearances now. You Skype
yes.
him and he gives you advice about stuff. When you were growing up, he was, I said down the mines, but he was an electrical engineer at a mine. He would actually have gone down the mines.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What do you remember about it? As a little girl, what kind of dad was he?
I remember... I'm astonished that it doesn't feel like he was an absent dad, because he worked sort of 7 days a week, 50 weeks a year. And I think, logically, that should mean that I didn't see him that much. But I remember seeing him loads. And all I can think is that he mustn't have slept. The times that he was supposed to be having a nap, he must have been with us. I remember that I wasn't allowed to play Kaplunk, the board game, the noisy marble board game, because I wasn't allowed to play that sometimes because he was asleep in the next room. But, you know, that's not a hardship, is it really?
So as we know, you were born in 75. The miners' strike came in 1984. Now, we hear, you know, we've heard so often and so interestingly by people on all sides of the miners' strike, but they always tend to be adults. So can you tell me, what did it feel like to be a child in a community in the middle of the miners' strike?
I think... I have purposefully kept my memories as a child, so I haven't really I remember it was hard, but I remember that the family were really strong. I went to free school dinners, and there was me and one other girl in our year, and we used to get seconds and sometimes cuddles off the dinner ladies, and I guess they probably felt sorry for us, but at the time we were just I'm never going to turn down a cuddle, no matter if it's in sympathy or not. And I remember there was a time when I woke up and the bed was covered in blood, and it was because my shoes were too tight and I hadn't told my parents because I knew they couldn't afford any new shoes. So I wore wellies for some of the summer holidays. But I also remember, like, the French miners that Christmas sent loads of toys. So we still got presents at Christmas, but it was very clear where they'd come from. You know, some other people in a different country had helped us out, which I think at 9 is quite an astonishing thing to learn.
Mm. Did you feel, even though children don't understand necessarily all the practicalities of poverty, they can feel shamed by the idea that they've not got the same as other people can feel? Did you ever feel that?
No, I don't think so. I think I just felt like it was just a thing that we were sort of going through, and that there would be an end and that it would all be okay in the end. And I think my family have always been strong and able to get through things. And I also think that if you've had no money at some point, you don't panic so much about ever going back there because you know you've done it. It's not very nice, but you did it and you managed.
Let's have another piece of music, Sarah Millican. Tell me about your fourth this morning. What's this?
My fourth is the theme from my favourite film, which is Thelma and Louise, and the theme is called Thunderbird, and it's by Hans Zimmer.
How many times have you seen the movie?
Oh, like a million. I saw it. It came out on the 12th of July, 1991, and it absolutely blew my mind. I'd never seen... So how old was I? I was 16. I'd never seen a film with two female protagonists before, where the men were kind of incidental, and it really made me want to make films. It made me want to be a film director.
Thunderbird, that was the theme from the film Thelma and Louise, composed by Hans Zimmer. Cinema is a great passion of yours, Sarah. It continues to be, but it goes way back. You used to write reviews, cinema reviews, didn't
I did.
You?
I'm slightly ashamed that I used to be a critic, considering how not very fond of them I am now. I started when I was 17. I wrote to a film magazine and said, do you think I could make it as a reviewer? And they said, yeah, probably in local papers. So I thought, good. So I approached a local newspaper who took me on. So I basically went to the cinema for 4 years for free, which was cool, and wrote a review, and it appeared in the free paper, the one that people put down for their cat to poo on. Lovely. And yeah, and loved it.
And were you working at a cinema when you met your first husband?
Yes.
You weren't writing reviews then, you were actually working
in the
cinema.
No, I was on the popcorn stand, and then became supervisor of the popcorn stand in only a few short months. I showed aptitude in popcorn management and absolutely loved it. Thought everybody there would be a film fan, but a lot of them weren't, which was quite odd. And I guess that's why I sort of moved towards my ex-husband and also a group of others who were avid film buffs.
And you got married at 22, which for somebody of your generation is quite young.
Yes.
What did you think? Did you think this is all settled now? Life is I know what my life's going to be.
It, you know, as far as I was concerned, he was the one, you know, done and dusted. Let's get it sorted. And so I don't regret it. And I don't know if I'd not married him and not done the things that I did and then got divorced and all that, I might not necessarily be sitting in front of you.
I've read you say that you think you sort of seemed to put a part of yourself on hold. You had these ideas about creativity and writing and then suddenly you parked that.
Yeah, I didn't write for 2 years. And it was certainly nothing to do with the relationship. It was just, I think, I was just enjoying being married and being in love. And I think I used to write as a way out of things. So I used to write because I had a job I didn't like and I'd think, I'll write myself out of this. I used to make short films and I used to get little short plays on at local theatres and things. And for 2 years, I didn't write. I didn't have the urge. And then it came back hell for leather when I got divorced.
Which was, how many years were you married for?
I was married for 7, I think. 7, yes. It's good that I don't really know, isn't it?
So it came back hell for leather. Tell me what happened.
Well, because my divorce was a surprise, that sounds like he burst out of a cake. I don't mean that. It was not expected at all. I was sort of broken and moved back in with my family, who were amazing. and I saw a workshop for people who'd written but never performed. And on a day where I felt amazing, because I did have up and down, obviously, as everybody does. On one of those days, I just signed up to this workshop, and it was mostly performance poets who've never performed before. And I did the afternoon workshop, and there was an evening performance, and I read a monologue off a bit of paper that I'd written that was shaken. And there were parts of it, and it was all about my divorce, and there were parts of it that were painful and parts of it that were hilarious. And I went into the ladies' loos afterwards and jumped up and down because I'd done it, because I'd sort of ticked it off my list. And then 6 months later, I rang the girl who'd run the workshop and said, I think I want to try doing stand-up. And she went, I know. Like, she'd been waiting the whole time for me to ring. And she got me my first five-minute gig. And I went straight from work, had forgotten my paperwork, like all of my notes. So just had to try and remember roughly what my jokes were, which obviously made them a bit more natural, I suppose. And the first 2.5 minutes, nobody laughed. And then the whole room laughed on just one joke about my dad. The whole room just erupted. And it just felt like, this is what I want to do.
So much I want to ask you about. Before that, though, tell me about your fifth disc of the morning.
My fifth disc is Chocolate by Snow Patrol. As far as I can gather, the actual origin of the song is it's about somebody who cheated on their partner, where for me it is about breaking out of a marriage and entering into a world of comedy where for the first time I felt like I belonged and like I could be myself. And it was terrifying, but also brilliant.
That was Snow Patrol and Chocolate. You were talking, just as you went into that piece of music, Sarah Millican, about doing your first 5 minutes of stand-up.
Yes.
And this little gig that you'd got from somebody who always knew that the call was going to come and that you really wanted to be a stand-up almost before you yourself did. What about before you got the laugh? What about 2.5 minutes of silence? That's a long time to be up on stage and to be getting no response.
It is, but it's just... It's all it is before the laugh. So, you know, there's...
You know that now.
Yeah, but at the time, I was terrifying. Of course it was terrifying. I didn't even know, like, what I was supposed to wear. I had no idea. I don't know if I knew I was funny. I knew I was funny amongst friends, and I think that's different. I think I just blanked out the first 2.5 minutes. I was just battling away, just desperate for this to work.
What made them laugh?
Oh, I did a joke about my dad when I first told him that I was splitting up with my ex, because I was sitting basically on the floor crying, just, you know, snot and tears everywhere. And he said, you're bound to be upset. You've lost everything. And then there was a little pause and he said, you've got nothing left, just as in case I was unclear. And it went from silence and people sort of judging, because they do, because they're allowed to. They've paid money. They're supposed to judge you. And it went from silence to this woof of laughter. And I just thought, well, he doesn't love me, but all of these people do. And that is enough for me for now.
Because a lot of those early years of your comedy was based on what you had, this trauma that you had been
through.
Talk about what you know. What's that like to display your pain and for it to make people laugh?
Oh, it takes away the pain, but it takes away the power. And also, I think sometimes you feel like you're alone. Nobody's ever been dumped like this. This is horrific. And then when they laugh, it's like they're saying, oh, I've had that. Yes, that's happened to me. And you feel more like you're in a group.
You did also, I read, see a counsellor at the time.
Yes.
So you were in need of... Another
sort
of help.
Yeah, of course. Oh, no, it wasn't. I didn't just do the comedy. I wouldn't advocate that to anybody. Just do comedy. That'll make you better. No, I think some people are promiscuous and some people drink a lot and, you know, however it is that they cope. But for me, I didn't particularly want to go on antidepressants. I just thought what I need to do is I need to talk it out. So I saw a counsellor who helped a lot. And I'm very vocal about how useful counselling can be. I have a theory that we're all a bit messed up, and those of us who are less messed up are those of us who've seen a counsellor.
Let's get some more music in. Tell me about this. We're on your sixth disc of the day.
My sixth disc?
Yes.
Is The Frog Chorus and Paul McCartney with We All Stand Together. And this is kind of slightly inspired by Desert Island Discs, because I listened to Kathy Burke's episode and she said that there was a Frank Sinatra song, and it was in the order of service of a wedding that she was at, and it said that everybody must sing with gusto. And I remember listening to that and had no plans to get married, and I'm not religious, so I wouldn't really necessarily want to sing a hymn. And I thought, how lovely to just go, we love this song, we want all of our friends and family to sing it, how awesome. And when I married my husband Gary, when we were sort of planning our wedding and thinking what could we pick that everybody would sing, he started playing this, so I started to laugh, and he said, listen to the lyrics, and I started to cry. So we played this at our wedding, and the whole congregation sang, including all of the noises. We made sure all the noises were in the order of service as well, and this is what we walked out of the wedding to.
Rainbow blues, sing or swim, one thing is certain, we'll never give in. Side by side, hand in hand, we all stand together.
That was Paul McCartney with We All Stand Together, the Frog Chorus. And Sarah Millican, I think I can reasonably say that you may be the only person who's ever had that sung at their wedding. And when it was playing there, you were going between laughter and sometimes looking like you might have been close to tears. It still makes you emotional, does it?
Yeah, I think because I'm the sort of person who doesn't really listen to lyrics. I learn them, I sing along, but that is what marriage is to me. It's no matter what happens, we'll still be here. Side by side.
So happily married now to your husband,
yes.
Gary, as you say. And how did you meet?
We met at my second ever gig. He was replacing somebody else, so I could quite well have married someone else. Like, I'd planned to marry whoever is at this gig, I will marry. It was my second ever gig. I was doing an open spot, which is like the tryout spot in the middle. And the first thing he ever said to me was, you rock. And I had rocked, to be fair. So had he. We both rocked. And we sort of kept in touch. And then we just gradually fell in love.
I worry that two stand-ups is a bit like two actors in the same house. One of you's working and the other one's not getting
the
gigs.
Oh, I thought you meant
just
unbearable. that's what two actors is. Oh, now everybody knows what I think of actors. Oh, no.
You've won plenty of awards throughout the years. You were nominated relatively recently for a BAFTA. Now, you know, these situations are often loaded because everybody's meant to be sort of smiley and happy and it's wonderful and everybody's all dressed up. And you got it in the neck at that BAFTA ceremony for what you were wearing.
Yeah.
Which was a perfectly lovely dress. Did that annoy you? Did it upset you?
All of those things. I was thrilled to be there and put in the same category as, you know, like Anton Deck and Alan Carr and Graham Norton. And it was so flattering. And then to be pulled apart for something that is so unimportant seems really odd. Say, for example, I saw somebody and I thought, ooh, that's brave. I don't go up to her and tell her, which is exactly what Twitter and Facebook are. It's just pointing somebody on, tapping them on the shoulder and saying, you look rubbish. You shouldn't be wearing that. You're too fat for that. You're too ugly for that. Of course that hurts. It shouldn't matter. I'm on the red carpet because there is literally no other way into the BAFTAs. There was another way, nobody would go on the red carpet.
Will you be getting a stylist for the next time you're nominated?
Absolutely not. If I'm nominated again, I will wear exactly the same dress again.
Will you? The same one?
Yeah, because the public, generally fans, nice people, realise how unimportant it is. Am I funny? Yes. Do you care what I have on? No. As long as I'm covered, as long as nothing's hanging out. Unless I wanted to hang out. I think that's enough.
Let's have your seventh. Tell me about this, Sarah Millican.
My seventh is the theme from the film Superman, which is composed by John Williams. And, you know, if you've got something scary to do that day, and that could be work or that could be home or that could be health or anything scary, if I put that on, I feel a little bit better about tackling something. I feel like I'm ready. And so I would play it on the way to a TV recording. I would play it on the way to a hospital visit. I would play it on to all sorts of things. Anything where I feel like I just need like a leg up. It makes me feel invincible.
Thank you.
composed by John Williams. That was the theme from the film Superman. And you said going into that, Sarah Millican, it's the sort of music you play to make sure that you are ready for anything. Your show has made your dad into a little bit of a star.
Mm.
And you ask him for his opinion on a particular subject. What's the best piece of advice he's given you?
The best piece of advice he's ever given me is that there's no such thing as can't. The only thing you can't do, there's only one thing you can't do, and that is stick your bum out of your bedroom window, run downstairs into the garden and throw stones at it. Everything else is achievable. And that is great, though, because it means every time you come up against something, you think, oh, I can't do that. You think, well, it's not the bum and the stones thing, so it must be achievable. And it's a pretty good attitude.
The years that I have watched you, I'm very conscious that in your most recent stuff, you're getting better and better and better. Do you feel yourself that as you get on, your writing is getting better and your comedy is becoming more substantial?
Yeah, that's the point. It has to get better. If all you do is the same material and all you never write and you never learn and you never get better, then you might as well be doing 9 to 5 in a job you don't really like. This is the best job in the world. Why wouldn't I want to make it as good as it can possibly be?
That relationship that is clearly crucial to you professionally and maybe even personally between you and the audience, you will be all alone on the island. How will you be without an audience in your life?
Well, I'm not very good at not being applauded regularly, I've realised. I like a good clap. I recently had some time off over the summer and therefore nobody told me I was funny every day. And my husband laughs. But it's not the same as like 2,000 people. So I had to get used to that. But I think if there's any animals that could be trained to clap, then they would be the ones that I wouldn't eat.
Tell me about your final then. What are we going to hear, your final disc?
My final disc is Homeward Bound by Simon and Garfunkel. And when I'm building a boat, this is the thing that would keep home in my eye, just to remind me of what I'm striving for and what I need to get back to and where I ultimately belong and I'm happiest.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Homeward,
that was Simon and Garfunkel and Homeward Bound. So, Sarah Millican, the moment has arrived. When I give you the books, you get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along with you. What's it going to be?
I'd like a survival book by Bear Grylls or another, just basically something that tells me how to build a boat and how to like drink my whey. And I know I have to do these things because
right.
I'm determined to get off the island.
Okay.
And I think a book to help would be good.
That's yours then. And a luxury too.
Can I have notebooks and pens?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think writing would stop me going mad. And yeah. Then when I did get off, which I will, I would already have like a show written and ready to try out in front of audiences.
Okay, that's yours. And if you had to save just one track, which one would it be?
It would be Superman, only because I can sing most of the others. And I think that's the track that would get me out of bed every day.
It's yours.
Thank you.
Sarah Millican, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
What an honour. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.